Destination Freedom. Destination Freedom, dramatizations of the great democratic traditions of the Negro people, is brought to you by station WMAQ as a part of the pageant of history and of America's own Destination Freedom. Today, Destination Freedom departs from its regular format to bring you one of the most vital human rights reports to be made in this decade. It is a carefully documented report by a committee of prominent American educators, churchmen, jurists, business, and civic leaders. In a factual presentation of the work of the National Committee on Segregation in the Nation's Capital, Destination Freedom brings you the chapter entitled Segregation Incorporated.
In this program, there are no invented scenes or imaginary incidents.
Segregation Incorporated is strictly non-fictional.
The stage for today's chapter is set along the banks of the beautiful Potomac, a site picked by George Washington as the capital of our country. A sight seen yearly by millions of visitors from all over the country and from overseas. The steel and granite government buildings, the marble monuments of Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln are shrines symbolizing the meaning of America. And by plane, by train, by bus, by car, citizens come from all over America, the world, to get a brighter sense of what America stands for.
They visit the galleries, gape at the buildings, read the inscriptions, alone or touring in groups like this one.
This is it, folks, the greatest capital on anybody's earth. Right over there is the U.S. Mint, where the money's paid. And right over there, if you stand up, you can see the White House where the president is right this minute.
Suppose right here, before this cross-section of America, we stop the bus and tap the shoulder of the barker and point out to his tourists another side of the Washington story.
Look, there's nothing about Washington I don't know. Been a guide for 20 years. I point out everything. I don't miss a thing.
This is the only major capital in the world where one-fourth of its people cannot eat in a public restaurant.
And the only capital in the world where race segregation is supported by the government.
All right. I know all about that. I know that. There's things I don't tell tourists, sure. Way I figure it, no use letting strangers see what they don't ask for. Some things you just keep secret.
Is Washington's segregation a secret?
Listen to this letter from an official of Denmark who spent several months in Washington on a mission for his king.
Dear friends in America, before coming to your country, I had of course heard about your racial system, and I remember being mildly puzzled by this inconsistency in your democratic ideals. But I'm afraid I was quite unprepared for what I saw in Washington. On the streets and sidewalks, I noticed both races mingled freely. But when I went to eat my first meal in a Washington drugstore...
Yeah, what's yours?
Bacon and eggs, please.
Adam and Eve on a wrap. Next?
This gentleman behind me is next, I believe.
What gentleman?
I suppose it's me. I'd like a cup of coffee and some of
those
donuts.
Some sense in your head. We don't serve Negroes in here. You know us. Now, come on. Make room for the customer.
Listen, I'm hungry. I haven't got time to argue, miss.
The argument's over. Or do I have to call on that cop to convince you? All right, now. Next. Oh, here's your bacon and eggs, mister. Well, what's the matter? You don't want it?
I'm afraid not. Here's some money.
Well, what's the matter? They're fresh eggs. Your stomach upset?
Yes. My stomach is very upset. Very upset.
Well, I'll be. Some of them foreigners sure are finicky. Next!
I was sick because this reminded me of the discrimination I had seen in my Denmark during the Nazi occupation. Only, and there was another race involved. I remember the terror that went with it. I was confused. I'd read your Bill of Rights. I'd heard your representatives in the United Nations demand freedom for citizens in Greece and Romania, Bulgaria. But in Washington... Well, I visited your government offices in the weeks that followed. They seemed much like my own state offices in Denmark. until I noticed that one group of people were employed almost solely in menial capacities. Messengers, low clerks, porters in some departments, not at all. These were the Negroes. In my hotel, I noticed that no Negroes dined at the restaurants or were allowed to rent rooms. And for the first time in my life, I saw a sign on the door of a washroom that said,
"For white only."
And another that said,
"For colored."
It is no exaggeration to say that most of our people who come to your capital go home with what you call a bad taste in their mouth. In real humility, I say that I do believe you Americans should decide your destiny in accordance with your own wishes. But is Washington a good salesman for democracy?
Yes, every incident and every court decision affecting Negro rights in this country speaks directly to a world audience that is only one-third white. They look at Washington across the footlights of the American stage. And even if we wished, we could not dim the lights nor lower the curtain.
September 13th, 1948. On this date, there was a meeting held by the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Constitution Hall. Diplomats, attachés, representatives from 40 countries were being seated.
The President of the United States was expected to speak.
If it had been broadcast, it might have sounded like this.
We're broadcasting from Constitution Hall, ladies and gentlemen. Down below my booth is one of the greatest gatherings of friendly guests seen in Washington in a long time. I believe I see the Ethiopian minister. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. There's some disturbance down there. The usher is motioning to the Ethiopian minister to take a seat at the rear of the auditorium. The minister is leaving his seat, walking towards the back. No, he's walking out altogether. I don't know what happened, but I see the president about to speak. We'll switch you to the rostrum.
No one seemed to know what happened. And before an investigation could be made, the following note was received by the State Department.
The Ethiopian government considers the offense to its accredited representative as grave and prone to create serious implications. Especially so because the offense occurred in a public place and in the presence of the President of the United States.
Is segregation a secret?
To the hundreds of dark-skinned diplomats and officials from Asiatic and Latin American countries who visit Washington as a part of their job, this secret is open knowledge.
Case 98. An influential Puerto Rican senator who comes to Washington frequently and who once had to sleep couch in the resident commissioner's office because the hotels wouldn't house him.
Case 134, that of a devout Christian from Panama who came into a church in Washington. And as he knelt at prayer, a clergyman handed him a slip of paper and said,
"We have special churches for Negroes in Washington. On the back of that paper, you'll find the address of one."
"But isn't this church
for white Christians, my son. Go to the address on the back of the paper, and you'll be welcome there, not here."
Inside many of the largest churches in Washington, visitors are made unwelcome. Segregation is even the public policy in Washington of such Christian organizations as the YMCA, who insist that dark-skinned guests be housed in segregated branches.
This has made Washington the only capital in the world where it is necessary to chaperone foreign diplomats to protect them from insult because of their color.
Is segregation a secret?
Not to the quarter of a million Negroes who are born here, come here and die here, and call it home.
"My name is Sergeant Baker. You may not have heard of it, it doesn't matter. What matters is what happened when I came home on leave from my Army Air Corps unit. It was during the war. I was a picture playing downtown on military aviation. My lawyer had asked me to see it. I went to the theater. The manager stopped me."
"What do you want here, boy?"
"Sergeants of the United States Army are not referred to as boy, mister."
"You can't come in this theater. We don't have a segregation balcony yet." "Say, aren't you that Baker boy used to run up and down Pennsylvania Avenue in short pants? I thought I recognized you, even in that uniform. Well, you sure have grown, boy."
"I'm sorry you haven't.
Well, well, well. Welcome home, Baker. See by them pads on your arm, you've been to France, Italy, Germany. You've been around, son. Come back next month when my segregation balcony's fixed. You're welcome any time then. Sure glad to see you safe in Washington, boy. Ain't no place like it, is there?
In a way, there isn't. The exclusive policy of Washington theaters and auditoriums have brought the Capitol and the country much notoriety. When the Daughters of the American Revolution refused to permit the use of Constitution Hall for a concert by Marian Anderson, every Capitol in the world heard about it. And a few people did something about it.
When Negro War veterans like Sergeant Baker were barred from seeing the play Joan of Lorraine at Listener Auditorium in the fall of 1946, the starring actress stood on the stage and told her audience,
I heard a few days ago that no Negro can come into this theater, and in the capital city, too. Before I came to America, I did not know there was any place where colored people could not come in. Until this is a free city, I shall never play in it again.
Those were the words of Ingrid Bergman. And in 1948, the Actors' Equity Association voted to stay away from the theaters in Washington until race discrimination ended.
There are, nevertheless, a quarter of a million American citizens of Negro descent who live here along the Potomac River and cannot stay away until discrimination is ended. When did it start?
In the 19th century, thousands of Negroes and white people from surrounding states lived together in the District of Columbia on a basis of equality and respect. One old Washingtonian recalls,
15th and New York Avenue, now a part of the downtown area where no Negro can see a show or sit down to eat, was once owned by old Alfred Lee, a colored feed dealer who bought it from the British Embassy. Colored folks lived pretty near any place in Washington in them days. This here segregation is a new idea. You know, some folks say the time is not ripe for colored people to have equal rights as citizens in the capital. But shucks, way back in 1872, the district had a law that gave all citizens equal rights in public places. Rights to penalties for the violators, too. Sure, we've gone backwards, not forwards. Yeah, sometimes I wonder whatever became of that law.
That law mysteriously disappeared from the compiled statutes of the District of Columbia. There is no record of its repeal.
But the record of what segregation has done to the city of the Cherry Blossom Festival can be seen in its slums.
Washington has the ugliest slums in the nation. In the words of Agnes E. Meyer of the Washington Post, February 6, 1944.
In my journey through the war centers, I have visited the worst possible housing, but not in the Negro slums of Detroit. Not even in the southern cities have I seen human beings subjected to such unalleviated wretchedness as in the alleys of our own city of Washington.
And as a result of this segregation, the odds against Negroes in Washington are calculated in cold figures.
Only 30% of the residents of the District of Columbia are Negroes. Yet Negroes occupy 70% of the slum housing.
And have 69% of the felony arrests.
In 1944, a Negro in Washington was more than four times as likely to die from tuberculosis as a white resident, and almost twice as likely to die from TB as a Negro living elsewhere.
In 1946, the incidence of infant mortality among Negroes was twice that of whites, and Negro mothers were six times as likely to die as white mothers.
On the maps and charts of Washington sociologists, the segregated areas rate high in death and disease and juvenile crime. Who is responsible for these segregated areas?
At a meeting of the Real Estate Board in 1948, a vote was taken on its code of ethics, a code in practice for a half century. Among the active members of this board are 25 banks, insurance and title companies, and building and loan associations. The vote is taken. The chair is ready to recognize the count.
The vote in favor of reaffirming our code of ethics is 18 in favor, 1 against. Will the secretary please read Section 5, Article 15 of the code?
No property in a white section of Washington should ever be sold, rented, advertised, or offered to colored people by board members. In case of doubt, advice from the Public Affairs Committee should be obtained.
The business of reaffirming segregation finished. The gentlemen go to their offices to practice what they preach, to bar Negroes from most of the growing cities, and to confine them tighter and tighter in racial ghettos. Under their code of ethics, they have acted jointly to deprive colored citizens of their equal right to purchase, lease, sell, and hold property. On what grounds, a board member was asked.
Well, everybody knows Negroes depreciate property values.
The National Association of Real Estate Board says this is not true.
In a survey published by the association, it is reported that in the overwhelming majority of cases, property values not only don't decline with Negro tenants, but often go up.
Yes. I know that. The truth is, I don't have anything against Negro tenants, but some realtors and some of the investment people here in Washington like to build up exclusive neighborhoods. There's money in exclusiveness. You keep out Jews here, Catholics over there, Mexicans here, and Negroes everywhere, and you get what you call a select neighborhood. Well, naturally, being exclusive, they can call for exclusive prices. That makes segregation good business. But that's only half the business. The other half pays off even better. Over in the Negro neighborhood, you see, most of the people who cause these restrictive deals own property over there. You keep squeezing the Negroes in tighter and tighter. The loan associations won't loan them money so they can buy out of the area. And, well, you've heard of the good old law of supply and demand, haven't you? Operating all the time. They get wonderful prices for slum housing over in the Negro area. Understand? Segregation to some of us is just a matter of business.
Just a matter of business that pays off in death and misery and disease and the denial of dignity to 250,000 humans in Washington, D.C.
And as long as there is profit in segregation, the racket goes on. A racket growing not by accident, but by plot and plan by many who declare
race segregation here in Washington is a natural state, and certain groups which agitate against it are unscrupulous and un-American.
It might surprise the people we liberated from Nazi ghettos to know that race segregation is defended as both natural and American by the business and property interests that dominate the nation's capital.
But the only leaders who call segregation natural are those who enforce it.
In Washington, as the race lines are drawn tighter, a kind of no man's land is growing up between the peoples in the Capitol.
But in those few blocks where white and Negroes live side by side, the committee found a matter-of-fact friendliness between the races. And one white Southerner, case N46, said of her Negro neighbor,
"They've been living beside us for 6 years now. They take a good interest in their place. We say hello and chat all the time. Her kids are noisy at times, but so's mine, I guess."
It is not in the field of spontaneous human relationships that trouble occurs in Washington, but on a high policy level where segregation of the Negro is planned as a matter of business. And the results of the planning have been in tension and riots. Tension caused by the compression of people in poverty-shocked communities.
And in the words of the biennial report of the Federal Council of Churches of Christ in America, 1946.
Segregation increases and accentuates racial tensions. It is worth noting that race riots in this country have seldom occurred in the neighborhoods with a racially mixed population. Our worst riots have occurred along the borders of tightly segregated areas.
Instead of producing good racial relations, segregation creates a deep sense of frustration and resentment. Organizers of Segregation Incorporated do not wait for the victims to grow up before they split them apart.
In Washington, segregation begins in kindergarten.
Along the streets of the nation's capital, little children will soon head back to school. The white children to schools designated for whites. The colored children to schools designated for Negroes, passing each other on the way.
They cannot go into the same school buildings. They cannot study together. They cannot play together. Nor can they salute the flag together.
And the schools of the colored children are run down and overcrowded. In the school year 1946-47, the operation of Negro schools received nearly 25% less per capita than white schools.
Around here in Washington and in the South, they say separate but equal facilities. But nobody ever saw facilities that were separate and equal. Segregation implies a superior, inferior relationship. Otherwise, there'd be no segregation.
And both Negro and white teachers agree that by the time their pupils reach the third grade, they're conscious of their systematic separation. In this way, they learn about America.
Beyond the public schools, in the universities in Washington where no Negroes are admitted, segregation digs its trenches, divides the youth according to doctrines of blood and skin, and returns the racial product to society equipped with an academic degree.
Yet, the public school system has been the great instrument by which we hope to overcome social and economic stigmas and give each American an equal chance to make good. It has been the great unifying principle of the Republic.
But from the schoolroom and into the workshop, segregation moves with the men and women in Washington.
Herein is modern human bondage. For when a quarter of the population is barred from certain jobs because of its race, it must take what is left as surely as if it were condemned to slavery.
In the capital city, a Negro cannot get a job as a meter reader, a building inspector, a weights and measures inspector, nor a guard in a jail.
No Negro will be accepted for work above a menial level in the office of the Vehicles and Traffic Department, or the Engineer's Office, or the Purchasing Office.
Yet the proportion of Negroes who work for a living in Washington is higher than for whites. They work longer hours and go to work at an earlier age.
The committee finds that behind the system of segregation in the District of Columbia's schools, jobs, and housing is the full majesty of the United States government.
Yes, the main segregators in employment are the government, agencies, bureaus, departments, and sections. The Ramspect Act of 1940, the civil service regulations, and a series of presidential executive orders all forbid racial discrimination in federal employment. Yet discrimination prevails as a matter of accepted practice.
The main department discriminating against Negroes is the State Department. One high-ranking officer summed up the department's attitude in document 302.
The attitude is not Southern reactionary or plain Negro-hating, but rather the conservatism you find on the main line or in the Back Bay. I suppose it's a matter of the State Department regarding Negroes without any questioning at all as naturally belonging in the servant sort of role.
The only Negro who did rise to a key position in the State Department tells why he recently turned down a Washington job. Dr. Ralph Bunch said,
"Frankly, I turned down the job because I didn't want to live in Washington again. I've been refused service in Washington public places so many times that I never knew what to expect. And when one of my foreign friends asked the management of a hotel if they would object to my presence, they said yes, even though I was a State Department man. No, I don't think I'd live in Washington again, even to be Assistant Secretary of State."
And segregation still moves like a plague over the city and down into the hospitals where doctors segregate patients and doctors segregate doctors.
In this case, reported by Joseph Dean Lohman of the University of Chicago, lies the real meaning of race segregation in an American hospital. It was on the streets of Washington that the cab came screaming around the corner and pulled up in front of a Washington hospital. It was a cold winter morning in 1945. The driver darted up the steps. The clerk saw him.
Is something wrong, mister?
Yeah, there's a young lady outside my cab. She's in labor. She don't get a doctor right away.
Emergency. Nurse, Dr. Phillips, emergency.
Golly, I thought I wouldn't make it in time. Her husband's out there with her. Whew, was I scared.
Did you call for emergency?
Outside, Dr. Phillips, in a cab, a woman in labor. Hurry.
Oh, yes, of course.
You stay here, cabbie. They'll take care of her. Help me fill out these forms. Her name,
Well, I'm not sure. You see, I was cruising by and I heard someone call, and I stopped. It was right in the 100 block on Bryant Street, northwest.
Bryant Street?
Yeah.
She's a Negro.
She's in labor.
Sorry, this hospital has strict orders not to admit
Negroes. What are you talking about?
Yeah, clerk, I examined the patient. She is in labor, but, well, because of the rules, I can't bring her in.
Well, that's what I've been trying to tell this guy. Driver, try to take her over to the city hospital before
anything. There ain't time for that. You know it.
Well, I'll get you a sheet, and you can cover her with that until you get them over to city hospital.
It happened in Washington, 1945. For science stops, where segregation starts. In Washington, Negro doctors are barred from the district's medical association and from the American Medical Society. In fact, there is only one hospital in the city to which a Negro physician can take a private patient.
This segregation in medicine endangers the health of the nation. As segregation in housing and jobs and education endangers the peace and security of Americans at home.
It was not always this way in Washington. Once, the District of Columbia had one of the best civil rights laws in existence, and its citizens knew no segregation.
Washington was not always the capital of white supremacy. The federal government did not always ally itself with the segregationists. Now, it's a different capital.
Now, when the public schools of the capital are used to divide citizens on racial lines, to perpetuate inequalities, to increase them, and worse, to justify them, then the time has come to consider what kind of America we want to build in the future.
Here in Washington, the city that symbolizes the American way of life, is where a stand must be made for equality and truth.
How can we Americans make our capital city into the model of what we, as a people, and a nation, profess to be? By enforcing existing legislation? Certainly. By creating new laws? If need be. But first, to be determined that Washington and its people shall not be divided by a master race theory, and that liberty and justice shall be possible and shall be enforced.
The physical ghettos are obvious, but the ghettos of the spirit have darker passages and extend into the minds of educators, doctors, legislators, and divine. This is the darkness where men step on each other and take pride in doing so. The sickness that wounds the soul of our nation and lessens the meaning of its life.
In the nation's capital, we must mean what we say and give people of all races and colors an equal chance to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We must see to it that all children can stand together, and that they look to the stars and stripes and say,
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
You have just heard Destination Freedom's presentation of Segregation Incorporated, a documented report by the Committee Against Segregation in the Nation's Capital. Destination Freedom is written by Richard Durham, produced by Homer Heck, and directed by Dick Loughran. Narrators on today's program were Tony Parrish and Bob McKee. Others in the cast were Janet Kingslow, Dean Almquist, Oscar Brown Jr., George Kluge, and Fred Pinkard. Special music was composed by Emil Soderstrom and played by Elwin Owen and Roy Graham. Our technician was Al Johnson. Sound effects by Cliff Mueller. This is Charles Chan inviting you to be with us again next week, when Destination Freedom will tell the story of the great Reconstruction hero from Mississippi and the only Negro ever to serve in the United States Senate, Blanche K. Bruce. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.